Duval goes blue for Biden, but chooses Republicans down ballot. Voters say yes to more money for local schools. And the controversy continues around Lot J, some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Get on the line now and join us in this extraordinary week in America. It's 549-2937 to join the show. Then later, we'll tell you how you can visit the Kummer Museum for free this weekend. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a busy week in the news, we welcome one fantastic foursome. Emily Block of the Florida Times Union is here. Hi, Emily.
Good morning.
Good morning. Ann Schindler of First Coast News on the line. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning, Melissa.
Writer and journalist Shelton Hull. Hi, Shelton. Good morning.
Good morning.
Ann Schindler,
good
First Coast News on the line. And rounding out our panel, Bill Bortsfield, digital editor of WJCT News. Hi, Bill.
Good morning, Hi, Melissa. Good morning. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, everyone. Lots to talk about in a moment. Lots to talk about this week. We'll go to your calls in a moment. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. First this hour, though, the latest on the coronavirus pandemic. The U.S. now has the highest number of COVID cases and deaths in the world. 236,000 people have died from COVID-19 in the U.S. We also broke a record Wednesday of more than 100,000 new cases in a single day. The case count in Florida also continues to climb with an increase of 6,257 COVID-19 cases Thursday alone. Now, amidst the ongoing toll of the pandemic, the nation is breathlessly awaiting the outcome of the presidential election. Joe Biden stands at 264 electoral votes. He needs six more to clinch the presidency. Biden pulled ahead in Georgia early this morning, and just a little bit ago, he pulled ahead in Pennsylvania. We will be following what's happening in the Peachtree State very closely today. And in fact, we might go to our network coverage of the presidential election in just a few moments if they call this race. But for right now, let's talk about local and Florida news. We know that President Trump won Florida, and it's 29 electoral votes. It was striking to see voting patterns in our area. Republicans down ballot won all of their races. At the same time, Duval County went blue at the top of the ticket, choosing Biden over Trump. This is the first time Jacksonville has chosen the Democratic candidate for president in nearly 50 years. You have to go all the way back to Jimmy Carter in 1976 to see that kind of voting pattern. Let us know your thoughts about that. It's 549-2937. Ann Schindler, let's begin with you. It looked as though in Jacksonville we saw some ticket splitting on election night. How do you read those results?
Well, you know, some of the best analysis I've seen of this is from my colleague Andrew Pantazzi, saying that while Biden took Duval, that down ballot Democrats did not do well overall. And he had a good line about how they seem to like some of the Democrat agenda voters, but not so much the Democrats themselves. So, you know, there were issues that in the state and in Duval County were successful, like the minimum wage, which would seem to attach to the Democratic Party. But in fact, the local candidates, the county level candidates, and the state and congressional candidates voted on in Duval County, those were all Republican victories except for the incumbents.
That's right. Shelton Hull, what about that? It shows an area in transition and a region that we're seeing go through demographic change. But that's still through tradition and some combination of gerrymandering still favors Republicans for local and regional office. What are your thoughts?
Well, absolutely. It's always hard to beat an incumbent, especially when the incumbent's party is sitting at the top of the White House. It creates like a really strong momentum that will often carry even weaker candidates through to victory. I think what we've seen this year is that for years, Democrats in Northeast Florida have been really struggling to get their organization up to snuff. They've had a lot of good candidates, but they've not been able to really close the deal. I think what we've seen this year is starting back in 2018 with the whole the success of Andrew Gillum, the success of Amendment 4, the success of Amendment 2. Now they're starting to get a little bit of that momentum behind them. You look at cases like Donna Deegan versus John Rutherford. She was able, she didn't win, but she was able to do very well and make it a competitive race when normally that district would not be open and available to Democrats at all. You can debate the extent to which the president's influence has made things easier for Democrats here in terms of fundraising, in terms of getting people out to the polls that wouldn't normally be able to do it. But I think for progressives in the state of Florida in general, in the South in general, as well as Northeast Florida, there's a lot of good news coming out of this election.
Emily Block, what about that? It's interesting, as Shelton pointed out, that in our region, we saw Jacksonville go for Biden. Of course, surrounding counties, St. John's, Nassau, Clay, voted heavily for President Trump. Statewide, as Shelton pointed out, voters did approve what many might call a progressive measure, a decision to increase Florida's minimum wage to $15 an hour over a period of 5 years. That passed with just above 60% of the vote around the state. In our area, though, it didn't quite clear that 60% threshold. So a mixed decision in our
area.
Right,
and I think that speaks to what we're seeing statewide as far as voting patterns go. You know, there was no overwhelming area that would have pushed Biden's win over the top in Florida. And I think we'll see that with other down ballot measures as well. And again, Andrew Pantazzi, my colleague at the Times Union, really wrote a comprehensive analysis on all of this and those patterns. But there was not one other area or region in Florida that would have pushed Biden over. It wasn't just Miami-Dade. It wasn't just like Duval going blue. There's a lot just net gain that would have had to happen.
Yeah. Bill Bortsfield, you've been looking at these numbers as our digital editor at WJCT News. What, as we've been through this incredible week, and by the way, it's still going on. We are still awaiting final results from a number of key states in the presidential race. But what sticks out to you the most in our area?
Well, when you look at the what sticks out to me the most is that if you look at the two parties themselves, it shows that the Republican Party is the stronger machine in terms of being effective. I mean, if you look at the number of registered voters in Duval County, we have about 40,000 more Democrats than Republicans. But really, with the exceptions of Joe Biden and Congressman Al Lawson, it was a sweep for the Republicans. So if yes, there is gerrymandering going on, no question. And Al Lawson is in a heavily Democratic area. But in theory, you would think it would be closer to split down the middle if you were to look at the number of active registered voters, which is 279,000 Democrats and 239,000 plus Republicans here in Duval County. But that wasn't the case. I mean, if you look at our state representative districts, District 11, District 12, District 15, all clear wins for the Republicans. Mm-hmm. So it was a City Council District 4, another win for a Republican. So it does show that the Republican Party has still a lot of strength in this county.
Yeah, that's right. Ann Schindler, the race that came the closest in our area this week was the one for the clerk of courts. The Republican Jody Phillips, who's already an employee at that office, narrowly beat out the Democrat Jimmy Midyat. That was really the only race that was close. Why do you think that was?
Well, I mean, they're both fairly, you know, it's not usually a very competitive seat. It was kind of interesting to see. I think Jimmy has earned his reputation around, you know, a lot of LGBTQ issues and people who were unhappy with the former clerk or the current clerk's decision to stop doing weddings at the courthouse after gay marriage became legal. And that race got really ugly, at least on television. So it was close, I think, because there was a lot of issues in it that engaged the people of Duval County on a visceral level more than perhaps other clerk races. You know, typically it's a fairly functionary administrative role. I mean, the courtroom is full of drama, but the clerk's office typically is not. And so I think it just was because the nature of the things in this race became a lot more attended by the voters of the county.
It's 549-2937. Give us a call as we talk about the election and the top stories of the week. Speaking of which, voters in our area said yes to a half-cent school tax in support of Duval County Public Schools. Clay County voters gave a thumbs up to more money for schools in their county, too. Let's go to Emily Block, education reporter with the Florida Times Union. Emily, this was a measure the school system and education advocates had to fight and push for quite some time to get across the finish line. Your thoughts?
It's been a long year. When I started at the Florida Times Union, it was over a summer vacation. And everyone told me, oh, it's summer break. Don't worry. It's really like a slow time for education reporters. You'll have plenty of time to like ease your way in. And I did not because of the sales tax referendum. And, you know, now I'm here and it's been, you know, a year plus of the school district and the school board trying to get this on ballots and then finally on ballots and approved. And here we are and it actually happened. And I feel like I'm still pinching myself a little bit, but it was approved, which means that a almost $2 billion plan, a $1.9 billion master plan will start to go in effect. And the first measure that schools are going to see from that, the first tangible, is going to be security updates to all the schools across the school district, including charter schools.
Yeah, Shelton, of course, the reason this measure took so long to get through is because there was stiff opposition to it from charter school advocates. And they were able, through work in the state legislature, to get a carve-out of these funds for charter schools in this area.
Yeah, and a lot of folks are upset about that, that it took that kind of negotiating to make it possible for the thing to go through. But at the same time, as long as the money is coming through for the public schools, most people feel, let them have their carve-out. It's still an unfolding thing with security and infrastructure work on the schools. We're so far behind. We're going to spend all of next year playing catch up. And then once they do that, we can begin to negotiate further.
Let's go to your calls on this historic Friday as we wait for final results in the presidential race. We're talking local and Florida results right now here. It's 549-2937 to join us. Robert is in Mandarin. Hi, Robert. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Yeah, in terms of attempting to account for how there were so many local people who were, won in the Republican race, but the presidential race, the Democrats won, is there a way of knowing how many people only checked the presidential box but left off the other boxes?
Right, like not filling out the whole ballot. Thanks for that.
Exactly.
Yeah, thanks for that question, Robert. Bill Bortsfield, I don't know that we have any data on that, but I think that's pretty common. Not everyone fills out the ballot in its entirety, and it was a long ballot this time in our area.
It was, and if there is a way, I don't know anything about that. I'm not aware of any, you know, public data dumps that say 90% voted in one race, but only 30% voted in another. And, you know, things have changed quite a bit over the years. I mean, I can remember in my very first election, the old pull levers. And back in those days, you could actually pull a lever and vote an entire party ticket in one pull. So things certainly have changed
yes.
over the years in that regard.
I remember those ballots, too, from days of old. That was the old way of doing votes in many parts of this country. Ann Schindler, we are talking Florida news, but I don't want to leave out our listeners up in Georgia, because Georgia is one of a handful of states that could be called today for Joe Biden, depending on how the vote shakes out. It really is remarkable to see what's happening in Georgia. As Biden has pulled ahead of the president in the Peachtree State by just a sliver of votes. And we are still awaiting a new tranche of votes to drop there. But it's votes in Atlanta and it's suburban counties, votes in Savannah and a couple of other places that look to be making the difference in Georgia for Joe Biden.
Yeah, Georgia is sort of the nail-biter state that a lot of people thought Florida was going to be. And it really does show how the rollout of votes, the types of votes, and, you know, different precincts makes such a difference. The race was initially basically called the other way when the early votes were coming in, and without really accounting for just how many Biden supporters there were in the Atlanta metro area. So it's really, it's interesting to see it roll out, and it kind of makes it more troubling when you see people calling to cut off the voting in other places, because, it, you know, there are demographic differences in different areas of red states and blue states, and it makes a massive difference when you start to get to either the votes that came in earlier or day of, or whether you're counting votes that are mail-in ballots. You know, there were demographic tendencies associated with each of those means of voting that, mm-hmm. that are reflective of people's party identity.
Yeah, that's it. And Emily Block, the tribalism of this election cannot be overstated. We have just seen unbelievable turnout from both parties, which is good for democracy. And we don't know the final result yet, although we may have an answer today. But, you know, in my lifetime, I cannot remember an election this intense and this deeply felt. I really can't.
Yes, we've had record turnout in Duval County as well. I've been talking to young people, first-time voters, and so many of them were voting for the first time in this race and just so excited to have their voice heard. And they were the first ones to tell me, don't count us out. Don't, you know, undermine us. We know what we're talking about. So I think we're seeing a lot of that, not just in Duval County, but everywhere.
It's 549-2937 as we talk about the latest on the election with our Friday Media Roundtable. In a moment, we'll talk about another big story from the week, Lot J. Here's a tweet from Chris Hand, the local attorney that pushed the Duval County Canvassing Board to open up its process this month. He writes, the efficient vote count in Florida was positive, but there are other issues. Transparency was a challenge at the Duval County Supervisor of Elections office in 2020. I hope they will use their new live stream as a foundation for even more openness in future vote counting. Ann Schindler, you covered that whole journey through opening up the Duval County Supervisor of Elections office to more oversight. In the end, you know, as we've noted, the canvassing board, the vote wasn't close enough for the canvassing board's activities to need further scrutiny. But that was really remarkable to watch that process play out in this city.
It was funny. I was actually listening to some sound that I had from that first meeting where it came up, where we were arguing for transparency. And it ended up being a really rocky road to get back to exactly what we'd said from the start we would be okay with, which is having our cameras there, recording audio and sound, and not showing the signatures. You know, that was kind of the big deal. For some reason, the canvassing board said that they were fearful they were going to have to babysit the media in order to make sure that there were not signatures being broadcast. But when I was listening back to that initial meeting, we were like, you know, we're fine with that. And instead, there was this, you know, week of hiring attorneys, you know, working through back and forth, modifying their rules. And of course, you know, one reporter in this town really digging down on the board members themselves. And, you know, that generated a judge resigning from the canvassing board.
Yeah.
So, you know, that kind of pushback, I think that, you know, officials can well learn that, you know, a lack of transparency doesn't necessarily, you know, do anything except invite additional scrutiny.
Let's go to some calls now on this historic Friday, where we may get an answer in the presidential race shortly. In the meantime, we're going to continue covering local news. 549-2937. Scott is in Springfield. Hi, Scott. Good morning.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for the show. I want to ask about the 2023 mayoral election. You know, the Democrats infamously did not run anybody in 2019, just after Andrew Gillum and Bill Nelson dominated in Duval County, and now we have this. So it's safe to presume that we could have a competitive race there against Daniel Davis or Matt Carlucci, whoever it is. But I was wondering who the panelists think would run for mayor on the Democratic side in 2023.
Thanks, Scott. Shelton Hall It's 2020 and everyone is focused on the presidency, but let's cast our crystal ball ahead a little bit to when Lenny Curry leaves the St. James building and the jacking begins for the mayoral race. Given the trends we're seeing in this city, who do you see making it through the process to lead the banner for the Republicans, and who might we see for the Democrats?
Well, there are a lot of people whose names kind of get sort of tossed around in conversation. Carlucci, Daniel Davis, Garrett Dennis, people like that. You know, this week after this election, you see a lot of people on social media talking about Donna Deegan even. And who knows, if I were to make a prediction right now, I would say that the next mayor of Jacksonville would be someone that we haven't heard of yet. I think that now is a good time for someone to come sweeping in really from out of left field or out of right field, presenting like a new kind of vision, someone who is not really weighed down by the baggage of local political drama going back through these last 5-10 years.
You know, Bill Bortsfield, that has been a knock on Jacksonville politics for a long time, that the same faces tend to get recycled through a lot of offices and that it's a pretty small pool of players. It is hard to build, to win citywide, countywide in this city without institutional backing and a big campaign war chest, which makes it hard for fresh faces to break through. But we are heading into a new decade, and we are looking at a new kind of politics in this city, at least in some respects. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I think the names that have been thrown out are the ones, the obvious ones. I'll throw out another one. And, you know, we mentioned Donna Deegan more than once in terms of the congressional race. And if you think about her background, she is probably best known as many years at First Coast News. And we also have a city councilwoman, Joyce Morgan, who's a Democrat, mm-hmm. District 1, who also has very high name recognition during her years in the TV news business, and certainly knows a good deal about putting together coalitions and campaigns. So who knows? You know, again, we're just totally speculating.
That's
here,
right.
So who knows?
It's early.
It's a long way off.
That's right. That's right.
I'll just throw that name out in the mix as well.
Thanks for that. Paul is in St. John's County. Hi, Paul. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Just my comment was about how odd it is in Florida that we passed the minimum wage law and yet the election turned towards Trump. So I just wonder if people are voting like just more with their camp regardless, where maybe it would be better if people voted on issues rather than parties. Because obviously the minimum wage passed.
Thanks, Paul. I think it just speaks to the oddities of Florida, Emily, doesn't it, that we saw that result?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, like, that's data that eventually we'll be able to look at, like, to the earlier caller's point, if people are just voting in these major races and not so much focusing on the local stuff, we'll know that eventually. It's a little too early to tell, but, I mean, I'm inclined to think that that is some of what's going on.
Curtis on the north side. Good morning, Curtis.
Good morning, guys. I have just two comments. One is, in this world we live in, it's the future. It's 2020. There should be no way that a ballot should be rejected for simple mistakes. There is a way for them to make sure that all ballots are counted and all ballots are filled out properly. They send in satellites all the way to Mars, landing lunar missiles on Mars.
Yes.
It's insane that we're having this problem. I think that it's designed because the powers that be, some forces, don't want people votes counted. Number two, the comment someone just said about who will it be to take the mayor's seat next, I disagree that it should be someone from out of left field with a ton of money. It should be somebody that we can rate them on their works that they've been doing before they have stepped out and request to be elected as mayor. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Curtis. Ann Schindler, you know, you hear from Curtis when he talks about balloting. It is frustrating that in this country, in the year 2020, we still have so many issues around casting ballots and that voter suppression is a real problem in much of America. And that we can send satellites into space, but we continue, I think, as he said, to have so many problems getting voting right. Now, that said, Florida did itself pretty proud in terms of just the electoral logistics on election night, getting the result on election night in Florida. Other states, frankly, I'm hearing from people on social media this morning, they need to change their rules after this election and follow Florida's lead, start counting the early ballots the minute they start coming in. What do you think of that sentiment?
Well, I think one thing Florida learned is that nothing like a good, disastrous election outcome to force the change in rules. And this time we were ready for the process. I mean, a lot of times it really is these kind of hinky old guidelines that hang up voting processes. I mean, to the idea that you're stockpiling tens of thousands of paper ballots, but you're not allowed to flip them open and run them into a tabulator until 7 o'clock on election day. And obviously that is a outdated mode of process. But I agree with the caller. I mean, you think about, you know, your face can unlock your iPhone. And there's so many ways that we identify instantly with people who want our money. I don't know why we can't, you know, identify instantly with people who want our vote.
Yeah. Yeah. Cynthia is along the Ortega River. Cynthia, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I was just commenting on the, you were earlier were talking about new leadership in Jacksonville, and I think that we really need it desperately. There's a sign of a lot of weakness in our government in terms of yielding to the present moment, doing what looks really good right now, and failing to see having the vision to what needs to be done over a long term.
Yeah, thanks, Cynthia. And whoever claims that mantle of new leadership, it will be fascinating to watch who emerges in this city in the next few years. Lori in San Marco. Hi, Lori.
Hi. Hi, Melissa. So I just wanted to comment on the Deegan-Rutherford race, and that I thought it was very interesting and noble that Donna didn't exploit what would have been an easy lever to pull, which was to exploit the race relations and the law enforcement divisions that we have, that obviously that's Rutherford's background. And I think that would have been a cheap, super effective way to grab a lot of votes. And she obviously made a deliberate choice not to do that. And I really appreciate, you know, not sowing more division than we already have, because certainly where we see in the clerk's race, where they're the ad of the folks that were on the trip with Scott Wilson in Atlanta, that when they decided they didn't want Scott Wilson to run, they put the ad in and cut themselves out of the picture to make it look like Scott created that ad. I mean, so I think it's a very interesting juxtaposition, kind of the dirty politics versus the way that Donna chose to run her campaign. So that's all I wanted to say.
Thanks, Lori. Donna Deegan losing to John Rutherford in that congressional district. Congratulations to Congressman Rutherford winning a re-election. That said, certainly there's been a lot of discussion that Donna Deegan has a future in politics. We'll have to see what she does next. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking the top local and regional stories of the week on our Friday roundtable at 549-2937. Now, we have folks waiting on hold to talk about Lot J, so let's get into that. The city's investment of up to $233 million in Shad Khan's proposed development on Lot J near the football stadium, it would generate a return for the city of just 44 cents in revenue for each dollar the city puts in. That's your money. And this is according to City Council Auditor Kim Taylor. City Council Member Randy DeFore says, based on the talk she's having and the numbers she's seeing, the Lot J proposal is a sweetheart deal for Mr. Khan and his partner, the Cordish Companies. She said the only way the project makes sense is if the Jaguars Stadium lease is extended for at least 25 years, and they commit to a certain number of home games. Shelton Hull, is that argument likely to carry the day on the Jacksonville City Council?
The council likes to argue, so all arguments will have some traction. The real benefit, I mean, the real beneficiary from all this is the calculator industry, because we are all we are all armchair accountants right now. And I think this Lot J situation, we are talking about 2023. I think this will be the key issue moving forward that determines kind of how the political balance breaks down in the city over the next few years, kind of the way JEA was for the city coming into this year. It's worth asking, for example, how much the GAA situation helped Duvall go blue for Biden, or how much it helped things go blue for Andrew Gillum back in 2018. I want to point out, we were talking about down ballot races earlier. I heard from someone that apparently Midyet lost to Phillips by about 13,000 votes, and there were something like 17,000 non-votes on the ballot for that particular race. So that's a good example of how maybe people not paying attention or not being that interested in some of the down ballot races result in things that could have swung the Democrats' way, but didn't this time.
All right. Let us know your thoughts about the Lot J deal. 549-2937. Bob has been holding in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you, too, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to ask why we are not seeing Lot J put on a ballot for us citizens to vote on. I think our corrupt city government is simply setting up sweetheart deals to enrich themselves, and that's going to cost the average taxpayer lots of money and not help the city at all. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Bob. The Lot J deal, and it's subject to the oversight of the Jacksonville City Council. It's not something that can go to referendum. It's certainly getting a lot more attention than other types of deals like this. But, you know, we do need to point out the city, does deals like this regularly. They're just not as much money involved, and they're not as high profile.
Yeah, and I think to be fair, the city would find it pretty hard to do business on any scale with people wanting to invest if they were going to put everything to a referendum or even anything over a certain amount of money to a referendum. I mean, certainly, as Emily can attest, getting something on the ballot, that whole process is really long and also expensive and probably pretty discouraging for investors. But I think that what the city is looking for here is at least an accounting of this expense and a determination if we would do better, you know, investing in Lot J as opposed to putting our money in like a casino gambling. I mean, it really is right now 44 cents on the dollar seems like a pretty poor, you know, way to recoup any money on a property that's going to actually generate not that much in taxes when you think about the fact that city bed taxes go to the Jaguars already for stadium maintenance and property owned by the city won't generate any property taxes.
Yeah. Emily Block, as Ann pointed out, the way this city spends its money, whether it's Lot J, money for schools, and the JEA affair, that has just gripped the political dialogue in this city over these three big issues. And it will be fascinating to see if public opinion turns enough against Lot J that affects the way this city council votes. If I had to guess, I would say that in the end, they will vote this deal through. But we've seen how public opinion has moved the official power elite in this city on the money for schools and whether or not to sell JEA.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. It's been fun to sit back and watch this one as opposed to the school sales tax referendum, of course. And that's something that educators particularly have been pointing out to me, like how different it's going this time around. The ROI discrepancy, just for starters, was gaping, massive. And then going from there, just the amount of scrutiny that the deal is seeing versus the scrutiny that the school board feels like it was given when it had a comprehensive plan, it says from the get-go. So it's been really interesting to watch those two kind of commingle and overlap, and especially to see, you know, the mayor's reaction and support to one versus the other from the beginning.
Yeah. Jessica is downtown. Hi, Jessica. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. So my concern is basically exactly what Randy DeFore said. If we're talking about lending Curry the money, then we have no assurance in our lease that we're going to have the Jags after these 10 years. Part of the also concern is that we saw Curry not saying anything about the half-cent sales tax until, talking about armchair accountants. He is our accountant elect, and it's kind of interesting to see that perhaps we wouldn't have gotten behind a Lot J increase, but the city would have gone behind a school increase. And I'm curious where his money is considered when he's approaching that $400 million loan that he wants to give Khan.
Right. Thank you for that, Jessica. Bill Bortsfield, next up for the city council will be a vote Tuesday on Councilman Matt Carlucci's legislation to have an outside review. And then the hearings will continue through the month. There will be more review by council members. This isn't a done deal yet, in other words.
No, and this is exactly what should happen. I mean, I am encouraged that we're seeing a city council that is not going to apparently just rubber stamp something. To your point about Carlucci, he's calling for a outside auditor, Robert Charles Lesser and Company, and they want to spend $26,500 to do that independent review. And we also should point out the other side, where Curry's chief administrator is claiming would get $1.69 back for every dollar of investment. Also want to point out sources for all this information. David Bauerlein over at the Florida Times Union, our news partner, and Brendan Rivers here at WJCT News, you know, as far as the sourcing for that goes. But yeah, I think this is exactly what should happen. We should have a lot of debate, and it may well be that what we see proposed isn't what goes forward. It may be that we end up somewhere in the middle. We don't know what kind of negotiation might be going on behind the scenes. Might the city go back to Khan and say, we can only do this if we get that lease extension? Might the city go back and say, we can only do half? So we'll have to see how it plays out.
That's right. Before we talk about Florida-Georgia weekend, let me get Ann to weigh in on Lot J. Do you think it's likely that the council will hold the line and play a bit of hardball with this NFL franchise and say, look, you've got to commit to a long-term lease before we will set free hundreds of millions of dollars in taxpayer money in the middle of this pandemic and this recession?
I expect they will. I do. I mean, we saw a little bit of the apology of, like, Reggie Gaffney saying, how dare you even ask these questions? You're going to chase away this investor. But I think they've learned and are well chastened by their experience with JEA. The citizens were not happy with as far as that got, and it really was the council auditor in that case as well that brought the numbers that stopped it in its tracks. So I think the analysis is necessary, and I think that Carlucci is going to have his way in terms of saying, if we're going to spend this kind of money, literally the largest investment of this kind the city has ever done, we need to spend, you know, $10,000 or $20,000 up front to have somebody independent look at the numbers and see if it's worth our while.
We are talking about the top local and regional stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable, Ann Schindler, Bill Bortsfield, Shelton Hall, Emily Block, and yours truly. And before we let these guys go, after they have worked so hard this week, it is an election week now, not just an election day. Finally, it is Florida-Georgia weekend here in town this weekend. Now, due to the pandemic, things are going to look very different than the world's largest outdoor cocktail party typically looks. Usually by this time on Florida-Georgia weekend on Friday, there is an RV city springing up all around the football stadium. That is not happening this year. No RV city, although there will be some private lots open for recreational vehicles. No tailgating in city lots, although some of that will be going on privately. Mask use is being enforced as people come to the big game. So, Emily Block, this big weekend for college football fans, like everything else in our society, is subject to the effects of the pandemic. And so it's not going to be what we've seen in the past.
No, it's going to look totally different. You know, it's just going to be a very different landscape. I'm used to usually being out of town for the Florida-Georgia game because I'll usually... you know, Gainesville Fest is going on the same weekend, and they do that on purpose because Gainesville would not have the infrastructure to support both things at once. So, you know, we're obviously not going to see that right now. It's more like a ghost town, but that is what it is. We're trying to, you know, be safe.
That's right. Shelton, as I drove into work this morning, I saw a couple in red and black Georgia gear walking past WJCT over to the River City Railway development on East Adams Street. That's a private rail car tailgating area. There will be some activity going on over there. They don't call it tailgating. They call it railgating. But it's just a very different time than what we've known. And by the way, there will be the Florida-Georgia game and a Jacksonville Jaguars game played back-to-back this weekend.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, personally, for me, the big question is how are these social distancing protocols going to affect, you know, the street fighting? You know, going out and getting drunk and fighting with strangers is such a big part of this whole thing. Now, the good news is, because we're all wearing masks, it's going to be easier to sneak up on each other for the street fighting. But you're going to see more boxing, not as much wrestling. I expect a lot more roundhouse kicks.
A few haymakers, perhaps.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, and one more thing. The city's negotiating position on Lot J would have been a little stronger if they hadn't torn down the Hart Bridge ramps. That kind of gave the signal to Khan and them that they were going to be able to do whatever they wanted without much pushback. It's kind of like taking an engagement ring on a first date.
Here's a comment on our Facebook page from Gary. Lot J is a ripoff, just as the mayor did with the Hart ramps. Ann Schindler, the Florida-Georgia fans that are flowing into the sports complex this weekend are going to be confronted with this construction zone because those ramps have come down in anticipation of development in Lot J.
Yeah, it is a radically different look there. And, you know, because our station is emptied out, I don't pass that as much as I used to. So every time I come past it now, it's like, wow, that is different. And I think it's I'm of two minds looking at that now. I mean, I feel like it obviously was a, you know, drastic move to take down a perfectly useful and well-used roadway. And now that it's down, I'm looking at it and thinking also a really weird thing to put a road like through the middle of a city in an elevated, I mean, it really does, you know, create a no man's zone in some ways of livability. So we'll see. I mean, it's down now. It certainly creates a blank slate for somebody to work with. We'll see who's going to finance all of that, though.
And in the meantime, after a challenging election cycle, I want to thank all of you for devoting some time to appear with us this morning. Hope you have a well-deserved break this weekend. So thank you, Ann Schindler, Emily Block, Bill Bordsfield, and Shelton Hull, our Friday roundtable on this historic day where we could have a new president declared very soon. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
A
quick break, and up next, need a break this weekend? I'll tell you how you can drop by the Kummer Museum for free. We'll be right back.
Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. Distracted driving is deadly. Teens, yes, but adults too, and there are millions more adults than teens. Arrive alive. Let's end distracted driving.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
This election has been called a stress test for American democracy.
Do you want to be ruled by the corrupt, selfless political class, or do you want to be ruled and governed by the American people?
Folks,
It's time to stand up and take back our democracy.
I'm Ailsa Chang, the state of American democracy and what comes now. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 on WJCT News 89.9.
This week on Science Friday, if you're fearful about gathering with loved ones during the holidays, we'll talk about reducing the risk if you just can't stay apart.
There are ways that we can reduce our risks around Thanksgiving, but it does require some advanced planning.
We've got the plan on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Today at 3 on WJCT News 89.9.
State by state, county by county, who wins depends on which ballots now count.
No one's going to take our democracy away from us. Not now, not ever.
It's been a roller coaster week. Are we any closer to knowing how it all ends? I'm Jen White. We'll find out and bring you the very latest on the Friday News Roundup. That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, there's a lot happening at the Kummer Museum of Art and Gardens this fall, and you can check out some of it for free this weekend. Carrie Slattery is interim director at the Kummer Museum, and she's on the line. Carrie, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. So happy to join you.
So happy to hear your voice. So you're really looking at the Kummer, like so many organizations, to find new ways to stay connected with the community, and you've got a lot of updates to share. Let's begin with what's happening this weekend. People can come and enjoy the beauty of the Kummer for free. Tell us what's on the agenda.
That's right. So we have lots of free days, and you're right, this Saturday is actually our Weaver's first Saturday, and we are free all day from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., and we request that you register online because we have to manage the amount of people for social distancing at the museum, but we do allow walk-ins, and they've handled it. We really haven't had to turn many people away at all.
That's great.
So we'd love for people to come. And also this month, Melissa, we're participating in the Visit Jack's Kids Free all of November.
So kids get free admission all month long at the Kummer. Saturday, 11 to 4, is free for adults, too.
Everyone gets in free.
Yeah, and then on Veterans Day, you've got free admission for some people as well. Is that right? Do veterans?
Actually, you're exactly right. So Vistar Credit Union, which is a strong sponsor of the museum, is sponsoring free admission for the entire community in honor of Veterans Day. So we have another, usually we have just Tuesday evenings that Vistar has free, but now we have the whole day because it's Veterans Day.
Fantastic.
So another free day.
Now you're serving as interim director, but the museum has chosen a new leader. Tell us about that.
Well, we're very excited about that, Melissa. Her name is Dr. Andrea Brownlee. And she really is an award-winning visionary coming down from Atlanta. Her resume goes so long, I can't even start to begin to describe it. But we have some information on our website. But what we loved about her in the interview process was she said, I want to make the Kummer Museum a destination. And she really, I think that people will see that she really represents who the Kummer Museum has become. She's thoughtful, she's kind, she's very brilliant, and she's invested in the development of the next generation of museum professionals. She's committed to keeping the Kummer Museum relevant for our community.
Fantastic.
We're excited. She comes in December 1st. She'll be here.
And we look forward to that. Now, let's talk about some of the works of art people can see for free on Saturday. You have a new traveling exhibition, the first one since the pandemic began. It's called Cross Pollination. Tell us about it.
We're real excited about that. So we're thrilled we're able to offer our first exhibition since we closed back in March. And many museums around the country, Melissa, have had to cancel their exhibitions because of the expense of it and what COVID kind of has done to the art world, moving a lot of exhibitions. And what we're thrilled to have, Cross Pollination, it's called Heed, Cole, Church, and Our Contemporary Moment. And this comes from Crystal Bridges in Arkansas. And it is a beautiful, beautiful, just celebrates the beauty of the natural world. And it's just, it's one of my favorites so far, I have to say. but it explores the theme of pollination and nature and ecology, and as well as art-science relationships among artists and connections across time from the 19th to 21st centuries. So it starts with the beautiful Heed paintings of Gems of Brazil. And Martin Johnson Heed was actually a painter for Flagler. So they're stunning. But then it goes all the way up to our contemporary moment in right now in the 21st century. So I don't want to spoil it for people. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised, but it's absolutely stunning. We would like people to come.
Yeah, people really do need to come and see it. Go to cummermuseum.org for more about all of this. Now, we do need to note that because of COVID-19, you do want people to register for tickets. Yes. Can you explain how that works?
Well, when you go on our website, cummermuseum.org, as you said, Melissa, you'll see right away, you'll be able to click in just to register for a time. And, of course, it's free, so don't worry about that, like for tomorrow, right? So just register. Now, if you forget to do that and you happen to be over at the Riverside Arts Market or something or coming by, just stop in because we've been able to accommodate walk-ins with the flow of people coming in and out. And, of course, our beautiful gardens, which tie in so wonderfully to our current exhibition, and you'll enjoy those too. So we just want people to come enjoy. The gardens have never looked better. We restored our beautiful Italian garden this summer, so it's just a good place to come de-stress, which I think we all need right now.
That's right. Oh, don't we ever?
Don't we? And honestly, there's a term in the art world I've come to really enjoy seeing people do. It's called close looking. And Holly Karras, our chief curator, she provides really a great close looking in her virtual tour that's up on our website that she did of cross-pollination. So you don't even have to leave your home now. It's about a 10-minute tour. And she refers to close looking. And what close looking is when you come in person is just taking the time, because it's not crowded, taking the time to really look at the artwork. And we've reinstalled some new galleries, some beautiful work. Some works came back on loan that had traveled the country. So I think when you come, you're going to see a lot of different surprises, not just our beautiful exhibition and our gardens, but some other little gems, so to speak, in our galleries.
Check it out, beginning with Free Saturday this weekend at the Cummer Museum. Carrie Slattery, interim director there. Hopefully beautiful weather, too, to frolic through those gorgeous gardens. Carrie, thanks so much.
Great. Thanks so much, Melissa. Have a great weekend.
You too. I'm Melissa Ross. Be sure to join us at noon for the Florida Roundup and keep it here on 89.9 for full election results. We could have an official count very soon. I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great Friday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.